I remember when I told you that my keyboard got broken in a subtle way.
Yeah.
And yours did too in a similar time, and we thought maybe this is the OS X update thing.
Yeah.
And I said, no, it seems like a hardware problem.
Uh-huh.
It turns out it was a hardware problem. It also turns out that I'm a dumbest person on earth. Turns out the F6 key, which I literally never use, got physically stuck in the pressed position. And it was this way for a month, and I never noticed. And today I got it unstuck, and now everything works.
We cannot invest in people, because what happens when they leave? Yeah, but what happens if you don't invest in people and they stay? In 3, 2,
or, wait,
1.
Wait, because someone is just walking by. Jesus.
Hello, I'm Michael.
I'm Radek.
And this is The Podcast.
A sounding board for interesting ideas and insights. We discuss books we read and want to share with you.
As well as technology and productivity, which is what we do by day working on our app, Nosby.
Or whatever else comes to mind. But it looks like we're doing the books again this week.
The books and productivity.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's true. But I think before we start, I think you have a little PSA for our listeners.
What do you mean?
Aren't you, the listener, hearing this on a Tuesday, not a Wednesday?
True story. We, because of our TGIF Friday arrangement that we discussed in our episode number 60, we have also rescheduled not only our weekly review for Friday, but also we rescheduled our podcast recording. Mm-hmm. We record every Wednesday or Thursday at the latest.
Yes.
Actually, this one is on Thursday, but, you know, don't tell anyone. So, and we will publish each podcast on Tuesday. So you're going to have it even earlier in the week. So you have more time to consume our favorite fantastic content and contemplate the words of wisdom that will reach your head.
Yes, engage with our brand. We used to do this on Fridays, but because Friday is going to be a different day, we thought, okay, so we have to do it earlier. We don't want to do it on a Friday. And so we thought, okay, we'll do it on Wednesdays, because on Wednesdays we already have the design fight, which is something we discussed on one of the earlier episodes. I'll put the link in the show notes. And so we thought, okay, so we'll do, like, after the design fight, we're pretty useless anyway, so let's just do design fight, the podcast, and nothing else in the day.
What of course, you don't want to say is that we are useless, so we are going to to record
bad.
A podcast
that's
as
bad.
Two useless guys. Yeah. But what you actually meant was that after design fight, we are really tired, because it's a really... demanding meeting. Mm. So after that, we just want to just have some lunch, relax, and just talk and brainstorm cool ideas here on air with you.
Yeah, if we spent already 2.5 hours talking and productively, again, see the episode in the show notes, then we might as well talk some more. It's like really difficult when you start the day preparing for design fight and then talking for 2.5 hours to like programming work, for example. It's hard to switch to that mode when you start the day like that. But continuing with recording, that's fine. But I also didn't want to like record and before we record publish last week's episode, so we'll be publishing on Tuesday because of that.
Yeah, and I think it makes more sense to have it earlier in the week. So Tuesday it is. Let's see how it goes.
Tuesday it is. Okay, so this week we'll be discussing Smarter, Faster, Better by Charles Duhigg. We both read his previous book, The Power of Habit, and I believe we both really enjoyed it.
We did.
So I think this is the reason, one of the biggest reasons why we noticed this book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the thing. I mean, after his credentials from the last book, you know, this was an obvious choice. And again, it's a productivity book, so... we should be reading productivity books if we want to just improve ourselves and improve our productivity and just also see if there's anything actually new to be said.
That's right. So I think the plan is... So the book had kind of two... It was a collection of stories and ideas. And most of these ideas were like personal, like they're related to you and your productivity and your decision-making and focus and whatever. So you could discuss that first. And it also had some ideas related to teams, how to, you know, companies, culture, collaboration. So we could discuss this later. But first, tell me, Michael, what did you think about the book in general? Like, what the book was to you? How do you, I don't know, how would you rate it?
All right. So it was good. It wasn't brilliant, but it was good. What I liked about the book were, as you said, the stories, because the stories were like not the usual stories you would get, you know, like we very often say that, you know, we get the same, you know, similar stories by reading, you know, similar books. This way, it wasn't the case. I mean, and especially because I actually was, for example, was reading a lot about the Air France flight before the book. I was reading a whole article about that and analyzes why the flight didn't make it. And I like the stories. And for me, they were great. And I have lots of notes here. But what I really liked about the book was the ending. So I'm going to, you know, spoiler alert here. Mm-hmm. At the end of the book, the author just sums it up very nicely and gives like really good actionable, you know, items to continue. And actually, it was my favorite part of the book. Actually, I reread it or re-listened to it, I think like 5 or 6 times.
Oh, yeah?
To let the content sink in.
Hmm. Yeah. This book, like many books I've been reading this year, was not exactly what I expected it to be, I would say. First of all, there was a high bar, right? I enjoyed The Power of Habit really much, and that was like 2 or 3 years ago, so maybe I would think of it differently now, but then I really liked it. So I had high expectations, right? And the book, I think, like The Power of Habit, had a lot of stories. The author isn't a scientist. He is a reporter. He's like an investigation reporter kind of guy. So he's an interesting person to write this kind of book, right? But what makes it interesting is because of it, like he writes about these concepts through the lens of stories and kind of case studies, which was interesting. I was also kind of surprised about the content of the book because it was started as, hey, this is a productivity book. And I had like a vague notion of what a productivity book is. And it was very different from it. It was about a lot of... It was about a broader topic, I think. I'm not sure I would call it productivity because it was like about... Yeah, about like mental models and focus and goal setting and how to collaborate in teams and how to like spread responsibility and creativity and innovation in companies. Like, yeah, they're connected, but it was not exactly what I expected.
Yeah, and especially the earlier chapters, also about, for example, Toyota and stuff. There were like I was. You know, being the CEO of the company, I'm looking at, you know, through my lens, you know, at what he's saying, like the earlier things were you know, how you motivate people, you know, how you might motivate yourself, how you motivate people,
right.
how you work together, you know, this whole thing about, you know, sense of control and everything, you know, all these things, you know. Presented by, as you said, a reporter, helped me understand these concepts and helped me make sure that, you know, he did a thorough, you know, background check on these things. So they should be right.
Maybe. I don't want to, like, discourage listeners from the book before we even discuss the contents of it, but I was... a bit disappointed about the way the book was synthesized because it it felt to me like he got some like really, really awesome stories told very well. And then he would like awkwardly connect and glue them together so that they fit the broader point he's trying to make in a way that seemed just awkward. And even though I got... I got the, you know, quite a lot of value from the book, which is why we're discussing it. But it was at times weird the way he would tell interesting stories, and then he would make a broader point, which is like seemed only tangentially related to the story he just told. That seemed weird.
Anyway, so how do you want to proceed? I mean, what should we just start, you know, pointing out things from the book, or how do you want to go?
Yeah. You know, take your notes or whatever. What's one of the concepts you found interesting?
Okay, so for me, a very useful concept was, and something that he repeated at the end of the book, as I said, was the concept of the stretch goal and the SMART goals. Because the whole thing with the SMART goals, you know, the SMART acronym, you know, specific, measurable, blah, 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 is...
I hate this.
Yeah, so it's weird, but he gave really good practical examples, you know, and for example, there was this example at the end of the book, like how he is searching for an, you know, for this aviation expert for his story on the Air France thing. I mean, you know, to prove this and this point, and how he goes about this, you know, he creates this you know, this stretch goal, and then this you know, this SMART, you know, ideas, you know, it has to be specific. You know, I want to do this. I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to have, you know, these problems, but I'm going to just, you know, measure this like this. And then once this happens, I'm going to do that. So, like, I really like the structure. And this is something I've been experimenting right now myself with a few tasks that I couldn't, like, move forward. And so far, so good. So I'm going to report on this, you know, later down the line at some point when I've succeeded with that. But for me, this combination of this inspirational thing, you know, I want to achieve that. Right. And then some, you know, like pairing that with some, you know, with these SMART goals. I mean, with this, you know, specific and measurable thing.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I absolutely despise the whole SMART thing. Like, I don't even know what the acronym is. Like, it repeats those same ideas. Like, SMART, measurable. Yeah, I forgot the rest. It's like, it doesn't even matter. Point is, specific and measurable. And, like, I just find it really awkward how... And even in his examples, how he would, like... Well, I don't want to use this word. Stretch the idea of a SMART goal to just fit the system, the template of what a SMART goal is. I hate that. But the broader point is like, even though I would never call this a SMART goal, I wouldn't think of it like in this system. The broader point it was very good. Charles Duhigg, he explained this concept in psychology called the need for cognitive closure, which is like the desire for firm answers, the aversion for ambiguity, right? Like the high desire to like be specific, right? Just, you know, make up your mind and like stick to it. And like, it makes a lot of sense in general, right? Successful people tend to have high need for closure. You know, if you're successful, your life is probably organized. You know what you're doing. You've decided on your stuff. You planned it out. You're not you know, walking in the dark. You know, not knowing fully decided what you're doing. So the need for closure is highly desirable until it's not. And he made some stories about like why, but in general the point is when this is not in check, it makes you close-minded. It makes you unwilling to change your opinion. It makes you over-decisive. You know, you're focused on the specific and measurable. And so he gave this example of GE, which, you know, they came up with the SMART goal system, and like he gave examples of like every ordinary worker coming up with SMART goals. And like, it caused people to expend energy on the most inconsequential goals. Because if you're only taught to make specific goals, you're only pursuing specific goals, which are like super small-minded, right? You won't pursue anything that you don't yet know how to achieve. You're like bend everything to the will of the SMART goal system. And like, once you've decided that and decided like very precisely what you're trying to do, it's like, this is it. And that's no way to go. So like, you need these stretch goals, these ambitious goals you can't yet explain how to achieve. But if you only you know, if you don't know how to achieve it, then if you only have those kinds of goals, then they're vague and you're stuck, you're overwhelmed, you don't know what to do with them. So the book explained those two concepts to like give a very like specific recommendation that you should start from like stretch goals, but like successively, and like everything else that you can specify, you know, break it down into more and more concrete tasks. This way you've planned, you know what you're doing, you have the cognitive closure, which also helps, but you still always keep an eye on the grander goal.
Yeah, on the big picture. And this is, you know, this is one of the ideas behind, you know, last week's episode and TGIF in our company, you know, that we have this moment on Friday when we do the review and we go through our goals, you know, through our, you know, last week's goals, next week's goals, you know, our grander goals for the whole year or for next month or whatever we have set there, to have this time to review them and to be in check. And because otherwise, I think if we don't do this review, as you said, you will just have this cognitive closure and just keep on doing things without actually seeing the big stuff, seeing why you're running where you're running.
Yeah. And like, I totally noticed that in at Nosby, how sometimes people, you too, would have the like very obvious need for closure. Like, yeah, let's just figure it out. Let's just decide, make a decision and go with it.
Make a decision and move on.
Yeah. And sometimes that's exactly what you need, but not when you're working on something that is this grand big picture, this ambitious goal, this thing that has to be figured out first, right? And you have to be really careful with that. You need this need for cognitive closure to actually get stuff done, but you have to be careful with it because, yeah, like I said, it can make you over-decisive, too impatient to actually figure stuff out before you do them.
Yeah, totally. And now, like, as I said, you know, so little time. I mean, you know, reading this book just made me realize how, you know, how important it was to write these bigger goals down and just review them more often. And I have to admit that, you know, in the last years I haven't been doing that. I know I've had like this vague more or less thing that what I wanted to achieve, but I wasn't really sometimes, you know, in line with what I wanted to achieve. And the thing is that the problem is that, you know, we have these quick wins that just make us feel happy, so we focus on the quick wins. And we just don't even realize that we are derailed right now, that we are just going just different direction.
So what you're saying is that we would focus on the things that are easy to be specific about, but the grander goals would be so overwhelmed with that we'd just never keep it in check.
Exactly.
I haven't noticed this point, but that's exactly true. When I think of my goals for this year, just personal goals, like some of them we talked about, the dietary thing, the book reading, all sorts of stuff, like making goals and like decisions about what I'm trying to do at the beginning of the year, the so-called, you know, New Year resolution, it never worked. And this year it really does work, but only because I make this very specific kind of a weekly review where each week I make specific and often like easily measurable goals and tasks for each week that derive from the big goal, the stretch goal for the year.
Exactly. And that's why this mixture is really important. And this is, you know, this takeaway from this book is really crucial. The other thing I wanted to talk about is that is the whole Toyota factory story thing.
Sure.
It was a really good story, again, very thorough story, a very good one. What really stood out was that moment when this Japanese guy was standing, you know, next to this American worker, mm-hmm. and begged him, literally begged him to stop the factory, to stop the production process. And when he finally achieved that, and he just pulled the lever with the guy and stopped the production process, he apologized to him. You know,
the manager.
The manager apologized to the worker. I'm sorry I failed you. I'm sorry I didn't tell you why this was so important. We didn't work on this enough. And it's my fault. And please accept my apologies. You know, I'll try better next time. Right? And
this blew my mind. This was so Japanese. So good.
Yeah, but I almost cried when I read it.
Yeah.
But this is something that luckily, I think, I don't know, luckily, I don't know for which reason, but luckily, I get it. I have it. I mean, I have it in a way that I take the blame. I always take the blame. I never, I hate people. I hate people that don't take the blame, you know? Because, you know, if somebody does something wrong in our company, it's something, you know, it's not something right. The first thing I think about is not their mistake. Is I'm already going, you know, I'm already, you know, I'm, you know, far, far, far away already from that. I'm thinking, which mistakes of mine led to this person making this mistake? What I have omitted, you know, at some point? What have I done or have I not done so that this person did this mistake, right? I'm going there, you know, first. And then later, you know, I analyze the whole thing. But for me, the first thing is to take the blame myself, because the buck stops with me, and analyze it. What could I have done better to prevent this? What could I have done better to make it, you know, better? Actually, so to first to apologize, actually, as the Toyota guy, and think what could I... Because if we do that, if we first... Because if we start searching for scapegoat, you know, for somebody to take the blame, you know, then we don't get anywhere. But for this, you know, Japanese guy, it was obvious. This guy didn't realize how important it is to stop the production process.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't realize it because he didn't have enough training or enough, you know, he wasn't, you know, enough training or enough, he didn't feel confident enough to do that, you know, like all these things. So he knew that it's not this person's fault. It's their fault because they haven't provided that. And I really get this mindset. And I think this mindset is really important for everyone to, you know, to focus when there is a mistake, to focus on, you know, apologizing to yourself, you know, basically, and thinking, what could have I done better, and learn from that right away. Just go to the, you know, we discussed before, you know, this is a problem. Bring me the problem. Now let's figure out a solution. You know, this is, and instead of, you know, let's find a scapegoat, let's blame them and move on.
Yeah, it really reminds me of this other book, Your Brain at Work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this idea of playing against yourself. It was about one of the like primary, you know, things that can cause a very strong threat response in us, which is like status. When you feel like your status is threatened, this doesn't feel good. This is really bad. And the problem is that, like, especially like in a culture, like in a company where people are not like, haven't learned to question everything and question one another's ideas, it can really, you know, feel bad, because I want to give feedback. I want to like question an idea because I want to get to something better. But what it feels like to the other person is I'm questioning their status. Like I'm like showing that they don't know, you know, they don't know anything. They're not good. They don't deserve to be where they are, and that sucks. And like one way to kind of work around it, like to work around this kind of response is when you kind of gain the feeling of status by playing against yourself, by making yourself better and being better than the past you. And this way you gain the feeling of status, which is also a very strong positive you know, emotion, without causing anyone else to feel like their status is depreciated. And what you're saying is kind of interesting because it's similar. If you blame someone, that's, you know, what the other person who kind of takes the blame, that's not a fun position to be at. But when you or you know anyone thinks of themselves as the person who always takes the blame, when you take the blame just automatically without being blamed, you're kind of again playing against yourself. You're thinking of problems and solutions. You're making yourself and the whole system better when we're talking about a company, but you're not like, you know, challenging someone else to feel like crap.
Yeah, I have an article, you know, on that on my blog. I remember, take the blame. It's really your fault. Learn from it. Mm. And there is this article. It talks about it because, I mean, what we haven't said here is that the story was that, you know, the worker was trying to fix the car and he was approaching the end of his, you know, stint, and he knew that he would not be able to fix the car, and I mean to assemble it properly. So he should have, you know, stopped the car, do it right, and then continue with the factory,
right.
With the production process. And he was he was taught in the US, you know, style, not to stop, by no means stop the production process. And
stop the line.
Don't ever stop the line. And in Japan is the other way around. If there is a problem, stop the line right away, fix it, and let's continue. Because they it's not like, you know, the US companies were saying, you know, if we stop the line, we lose, I mean, that amount of money, you know, every minute or something.
Yeah.
And but the problem was the quality, because if the car is not properly done, then it would just, you know, have some really serious mistake, and it would just be, you know, derailed, and then it would be fixed, and it will be actually more costly to actually fix the car.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be as good as, you know, as if you'd done it right from the start.
The first time, exactly. So this is really amazing, and this is an amazing lesson for everyone. And yeah, something what you said is that, because I like this concept that, you know, instead of you know, blaming people and focusing on others, you, again, what we discussed in our design fight, you know, why we fight, is that we talk about concepts and we talk about things, and we are not threatened by our status within the group. We are threatened by the fact that we can create a rubbish application. We don't want that. Yep. So this is our threat, and this is our big picture. And we are allowed to question everything because everybody has the same goal,
right
there. And this is what also the Japanese person was trying to convey to the American guys. I mean, your goal is to have a perfect car. So this is your goal, not, you know, nothing else. So, you know, if this is what it takes, you know, to stop the production process, just do it.
And it wasn't about the blame only. It was about responsibility. Like the story was at the Japanese factory, the Japanese worker, he messed up a threading, and what he did is he stopped the line, and his manager came up to him to take commands from the worker so that the manager can help the worker resolve the problem on the spot. And that was amazing, this inversion of responsibility, that this idea that, you know, you screwed up, you just stopped the line, your manager is walking up to you to help you and take commands from you to do whatever it takes to help you resolve the problem. That's amazing.
Yeah, this was, I remember I first, you know, encountered this concept when I was reading a book by Stephen Covey, and there was this whole, you know, thing of on empowerment. And he said that the boss or the manager's job is to be an assistant to people he's managing, you know,
yeah.
to be resourceful, helpful person who should help his subordinates to get their thing done, because they are the experts. I mean, they are there for a reason, and you as a manager should enable their work as good as you can.
Yeah, the person closest to the problems has the greatest expertise about that particular problem, and so it would be wasteful not to give them authority to act on it.
Exactly, exactly. So really, you know, fantastic concept right there. in this book. And really, the story is the way he wrote it. Actually, I almost cried when this thing, you know, happened there. So
yeah. So again, push responsibility down to people who have the most direct contact with a problem, right? Like the worker who threads holes at the auto factory knows the most about the way the thread should be done. So like, of course, this person should be able and should be feel obliged to stop the production line to just fix it, right? And like, why create this this bottleneck where you have to go through like two levels of hierarchy to be allowed to do something which you know best just the way it should be done in the first place?
And you know, and this is why when I retell this story of, you know, of me founding Nozbe and, you know, hiring the first programmer, I hired was a person that I made sure that he was just way better than me. You know, I wanted to have a way better programmer because, you know, he is going to be the expert of actually doing the programming, not me anymore, you know. So I was still programming then, helping them, helping him out. But that's the idea, you know, this is what you do. So, and now, for example, also in our company, what we're doing is we're trying to hire more experts because, as you said, I mean, you know, we have a dev team that's experts, but, you know, also in marketing, for example, we're trying to right now hire really experts in certain domains.
Right.
Instead of, you know, trying to do something, you know, half, you know, way done.
No, I mean, this is obvious. You know, of course you hire the best people for the job. The idea is like, how stupid it is to hire the best person for the job and then make them slower and worse at their job by requiring right. them to ask for permission for anything. Like, this is stupid. And like for so many things, like often it makes sense because you have to get a broader perspective, or you're embarking mm-hmm. on a big project. So like it would be, you know, not good to like start it without the right idea. But for like more trivial things, like, you know, why we just found it so many times where it's much easier in the long run when like every once in a while you have to revisit a decision made by someone on the spot.
Exactly.
Because, well, okay, maybe it should be done a different way. But this happens, you know, what, once every 10 times? It's easier to like fix it than ask, you know, for every decision to go through this bottleneck. Often someone who doesn't actually know better.
And this sometimes, I mean, this brings us back to this famous quote, you know, the don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what I've been doing.
That's good.
Yeah. And also this like stems from the idea that, you know, it's what we talked, I think, about last time, the idea of trusting your employees feels so foreign to a lot of people in companies. But like, you know, and most people have jobs where like they're not giving any permission, any responsibility, like any power whatsoever. It's like this dehumanizing often environment to a bigger or lesser extent, of course, but still it doesn't feel like, you know, you can just make the right decision on the spot. And so like, of course you often end up not caring. Like, of course, when you're a worker at a factory, you don't care when you're, you know, treated a particular way. But I think it was also a quote from the book. People don't wake up thinking, oh, I want to suck at my job, right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, people don't want to suck at their jobs. So like, If you don't hire just, you know, bad people for the job, then just, you know, trust them to do the job. You know, give them the tools they need and get them out of the way.
Yeah, and if they fail, it means that also you failed by giving them enough resources or enough, you know, things, or, you know, just figure out what you could have done better for them to be even better at their job.
Yeah, and a related idea is, there's this study, this 15-year study of Silicon Valley companies, and these researchers found these five types of companies. And I think it was also mentioned in Originals, which is also a really good book. I think we discussed it. I'll put a link in the show notes. And they found like some companies were like star led, where like everyone was like an A star and like everyone was the best, or you know, something like that. This other kind of company where like it was like engineer crassy, you know, where the engineers were the best, were the bosses. I mean, that's Silicon Valley, so that's not very surprising. Bureaucracies, which is, you know, obvious. Autocracies, which is the same, but in the end, everything just stems from this one guy, well, almost always a guy, coming up with all of the decisions, and you better not dare question his decisions. And then there was this weird kind of type of a company, this commitment firm, where like people are hired, you know, not because they're a star, or not hired to like to carry out commands from this autocrat. Rather, people are hired because they care, because they're like interested in the idea, and like the whole like the ultimate boss, so to speak. Is the idea, is the goal, and like everyone is kind of calibrated around that. And that's kind of, that kind of seems old-fashioned, you know, to like hire people to keep them for a very long time and like focus on an idea. That's weird. But in the end, what I said last week, those kinds of companies might grow slow and steady and organic, but their employees do stick around for long. When it's about a goal and the company treated this way, it gives you authority, it gives you trust, and just treats you well. It's not about being the A star or just, again, carrying out commands. Then you want to stick around, and thus you dodge the big hidden cost. You know, the company dodges the cost of, you know, everything you lose when an employee leaves and takes, you know, their ideas, their insights, their skills, or their clients in some kinds of companies to another company.
Yeah, I mean, this was always like something that I never understood from many companies. Like, why would you hire really bright people and just treat them really bad and just let them walk away? You know, counting on some of them just because they will stick around because of inertia, you know, because they're already there, and you know,
yeah,
and you know, it's like, is this okay, again, this famous quote, you know, we're going to just, you know, start with quotes and everything, but it's like, we cannot invest in people because what happens when they leave? Yeah, but what happens if you don't invest in people and they stay?
Yeah, right? exactly. It's like, you know, when you go work for a big corporation, you're almost surely going to be paid more than at a small company, at a startup of some sort. But it's like, it's not necessarily because it's a better job. It's more like it's a tax on the fact that this job will suck.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you'd have to pay me a lot more. Or I don't know if you could pay me enough to like to get me to work at this, you know, dehumanizing environment of most corporations.
Well, I remember, you know, back in college, I got a gig when I was doing some like some kind of, you know, technology thing, and I just didn't like this particular technology what I was, you know, doing. But I'm smart, so I learned the technology, and I was, you know, doing this thing. And while doing this thing for the customer, and I got it for a really lots of money. I was promised a big paycheck. I mean, big paycheck, you know, when you're a student, everything is a big paycheck, actually. so for that, it was my biggest, you know, paycheck to date. And it was the first time I was like doing something on the computer while cursing all the time. And I learned my lesson that it's the last time and it's the last job that I accepted that I'm going to be doing cursing. You know, no money is going to compensate me for doing something while cursing. You know, I prefer to take less money, but just not curse, you know, enjoy my work.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Okay, so we just discussed like two or three ideas from this book, and we're almost running out of time.
Yeah, I know.
I think we'll do one more. One that I liked was this this mental model of thinking probabilistically.
Oh yeah, well, it was really high thing for me. I mean, it was hard to understand actually at some point.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. So there was a story about this poker player.
Exactly.
And the big point, I'll skip the story. The big point is that life is a lot like the poker table. You just don't know. There's no certainties. You don't know what's going to happen. The best you can do is you can look at the set of possible futures, which is the first lesson. Just don't think like you know or don't know the future. It's more like, you know, imagine the future as one of ways it could go, right?
Yep.
And you have a set of possible futures, and you can weigh and judge them, right? You can assess or at least approximate the probability that each of those futures will actually occur. You don't know for sure anything. There's no certainties, but there are probabilities. There are clues. There are ways you can assess what's more likely. And the thing is, human brains are really good at this kind of thing, at thinking probabilistically, at the Bayesian inference. And we like we instinctively weigh different options to choose the most likely outcome. Like this is how we process like almost all information. Our brains are very much probabilistic machines. Like we even will intuitively select the like. There's an example of how they ask random participants about. You know, say this monarch has been on the throne for this many years. How many years you think it's likely that he'll continue being the monarch? Or the same for a just for a person? Like, say this person is 40 years old. Like, how many years do you think it's likely that this person will live? Right? Like, the point is for like different situations, a different distribution model is appropriate. Some distributions are random. Some follow a power curve. Some follow a normal bell curve or an Erlang curve. And we will intuitively select the appropriate distribution model. Like we're really good at this, except for the biases, right? You will often make wrong decisions because you don't consider the actual kind of normal rate of what's likely and what's unlikely. And one big bias that I often have to remind myself of is the survivorship bias, which is we don't read, we don't think about failures, because if something failed, it doesn't get to us, right? We only see stuff that succeeded. We read books that succeeded. We see companies that succeeded. Like the information we take in is heavily biased towards stuff that succeeded and not stuff that failed, which changes the equation of how we judge the world and how we weigh likelihoods of what's likely to happen, right? Because we think success is more likely than it actually is. And so I think the important part of this lesson is that you have to really like seed your base rate. You have to expose yourself to the full spectrum of experiences. You have to, you know, read about companies that fail. Think about the mistakes you've made after a workday. You know, don't just come back and think, oh, here are all the great things you've done, right? I mean, if you don't need particular motivation, like if you don't already feel bad, then no, don't think about all the things you did well. Think of all the things that you did wrong, right? Just calibrate the best you can, calibrate your brain and the experiences and ideas you expose yourself with to reality. And then our brains are really good at making intuitive probabilistic decisions, but you have to calibrate it first.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we when we started embracing, you know, this kind of agile, you know, method of developing software, and one of the parts of that is when you have a sprint, then at the end you have lessons learned, and this is actually as you mentioned, is a great concept that, you know, that we stop and we have lessons learned. We start analyzing, okay, what went wrong, what went right, you know, where we could have done something better. We actually take the time to have lessons learned and not just say, yeah, we did a new version, we are great, you know, everything is fantastic, let's move on, like let's move forward, let's plow forward, right?
Yeah, and sometimes you really have to do it explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's important to be aware and try to overcome the cognitive biases we're prone to. And sometimes it's worth to explicitly think of things, again, in terms of possible futures, possible outcomes, and try. You can't calculate it certainly, but you can often like seek information to weigh probabilities of different outcomes. And, you know, as you gain more information, you can calibrate your kind of Bayesian model better and better, and you can figure out what's actually worth doing. And sometimes it's really helpful. It's really helpful to calibrate your brain so you can make intuitive decisions better. And sometimes it's worth taking a step back and also think of things probabilistically when the right answer isn't certain, and do it explicitly. And very consciously decides, is something worth it?
Yeah, there are two phrases I jotted down from the book. Learn to live with probabilities. So like that's the one, and it's strong if you think about it. You know, to learn to live with probabilities, like to really realize that, you know, each path is just a probability.
Mm.
And then second, nobody is right all the time. So yes. Something that I was to keep in mind.
I feel like we'll get back to this book in the next episode. There's still things to discuss, but we're running along, so I think we'll cut it short here.